From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. In the 1960s and 70s, the late Craig Claiborne led a transformation of New York Times food section. He introduced the 4-star rating system, and he dined anonymously whenever possible, in the process becoming a pioneer of modern restaurant criticism, a field that some say is now ripe for change.
Again, like everything we do, is inflected with a resistance to politics or an allowance for it.
That's Soleil Ho, the San Francisco Chronicle's new food critic. She recently replaced Michael Bauer, the Chronicle's critic for more than 30 years, almost as long as Soleil has been alive. Judging from the reactions to her first round of reviews, she's already making her presence felt.
Out of good intention, I'm trying to stay away from certain words.
Some say Ho is helping to reshape her craft, not only by doing away with stars and anonymity, but also by paying attention to race, class, and gender. Hi, Soleil.
Hi.
So you had a pretty full plate before you joined the Chronicle. Could you give us some background of what you've been doing in the food world?
Sure. So I was in the restaurant industry for about a decade, and so that means I worked my way kind of up the ladder, as people can do. So I was a line cook, pantry cook, pastry cook, all of these things, server. And in my off time, I would write. And, you know, in the past couple of years, I started a podcast as well. And so I was cooking and writing and making audio.
That's a lot. When we talk about the writing you've been doing, have you been restaurant reviewing, or has your writing till this point taken other forms?
It's taken a variety of forms. At least in the past, I've tended to just take on whatever projects that people asked me to do, because I just am always excited about experimentation. And so I did some restaurant reviews. I also did personal essays, more reported essays, just kind of a mix of everything, and then audio segments, of course. So I don't know, I didn't have a niche per se as far as format goes.
I think your niche has always been to represent yourself and the communities you feel that you're a part of.
Yeah.
Is that fair?
That is fair. Although I think that I've written more broadly as well, beyond my own like experiences. Mainly what I'm really interested in is analysis and bringing a certain level of cultural critique to food. You know, just kind of bringing up what it already symbolizes for us. You know, food is everything. It's more than identity, but place and time, just context.
Yeah, it's everything. Okay, let's get into some of your recent essays, because when your presence started to be felt in print for the first time, you dropped a lot of information. This was great. In a lot of different essays, and then starting with your reviews. But one of the essays that you wrote, which was really interesting, was about the star system, which you decided not to use for your reviews. Could you explain your rationale behind that?
So I have been thinking a lot about what constitutes a restaurant, right? I think it's an idea that's been in flux for a long time, and especially now when the idea of the restaurant is diversifying because of economic pressure, neighborhood sorts of pressures like gentrification. The idea has gotten a lot more flexible, right? It includes pop-ups and diners and fast casual and all of those things. And so, you know, the question is, should a restaurant critic care about those places? And if the answer is yes, do they belong in the same, you know, numerical, quantifiable spectrum as fine dining, the more traditionally considered restaurants? And so, you know, I was thinking about that question, and it just doesn't seem to make sense, right? Because your criteria are so different depending on what the aims of a certain establishment are, that making it quantifiable, like your evaluation quantifiable, just doesn't seem to fit, because it just doesn't seem fair to anyone.
What I found interesting in your essay was you also talked about other aspects of the restaurant eating experience that you're going to bring to bear in your assessments. Things like ambiance, music, which I find fascinating. I've always thought that restaurants create this world unto themselves that's bigger than the food.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, especially as someone who helped my mom open a restaurant, I realize, you know, everything, every element of a restaurant is there because of a deliberate choice. evaluating those choices is also part of my job, right? And thinking about how those choices either fulfill the purpose or undermine it or, you know, in between. I think that is part of the story and it's an integral part of the story.
So interesting. You wrote another really interesting essay about language. I don't remember the exact title, but it was basically words we will never see used in your reviews and why. So could you share those thoughts with us?
Yeah. So I decided to do this essay because I realized, okay, there's some words that in our style guide, right, that I discovered like, oh, we're not supposed to use those, or here are some alternatives. That's always a delightful experience when you work with a new publication, right? You look at the style book and you're like, oh, wow, this is our house, you know, word that we use for this thing. And that's different from what I assumed. And when it comes to plurals, like when you argue about the plural of bow, for instance, you know, that's really interesting. And it depends. But there are other words that are, you know, oppressive or, you know, that are inherently misogynistic, right? That you wouldn't use for the same reason why you wouldn't use like a curse word, because it just, you know, perpetuates this thing and these ideas that you just don't want to stand by. And so one of those examples, the obvious one, is the name for Citrus hystrix, the lime that's often found in Thailand, Indonesia, Southeast Asia in general. And, you know, the name that people are trying to use now is makrut lime rather than the other one, which is a cognate for a racial slur in South Africa. You know, it's not derived from that, but it is the same sounds. And so it like freaks people out to hear. So things like that, like where I, out of good intention, am trying to stay away from certain words. And I thought there'd be maybe five on my list. But as I sat down, I realized how much deliberation I go through when I write and, you know, attempt to not make other people happy. That's not my intention, but just to be a better, more conscious writer.
To be sensitive.
Right.
So I have to ask you about the word ethnic. Because there seems to be a generational divide. Some people don't understand why we're not using that word. Could you just give us your thoughts on that word and what are other ways of describing restaurants if you're not using a catch-all phrase like that?
Sure thing. I've often encountered the word ethnic in the context of food writing when people are talking about ethnic restaurants, right? Mm-hmm. And when you think about that term and what kinds of restaurants that captures, there's a pattern that emerges. And, you know, when I was sitting down and thinking about it, it didn't really make sense because when we say ethnic restaurant, are we talking about a French restaurant? Usually not, right? Even though the French, you know, ethnicity, they do have like an ethnic cuisine. And, you know, ethnicity is like height, right? We all have it. And so to use that term as a blanket to cover only a certain portion of restaurants, like Chinese restaurants or Mexican restaurants or Indian restaurants, didn't really make any sense. And the flip side of that, too, is the idea that there are people without perceived ethnicity, which, of course, makes whiteness the default, right? Because it's usually the Western European-derived people who don't have a perceived ethnicity. And, you know, that didn't seem right to me. You know, I don't believe that, and I don't want to perpetuate that idea. And so I don't want to use ethnic restaurants when really I mean a specific type of restaurant.
Okay, the other thing that you've decided to toss aside is sort of the cape of anonymity. I mean, all over the country, you'll find some people that feel more comfortable being anonymous and some people that just don't think it's worth the trouble. Why have you decided to be open about what you look like?
Well, there are a couple things, right? I am the only person in the world with my name. So there's that. If you Google Soleil Ho, you will find exactly my face everywhere, all over the page. And that is something that just preceded me having this job. You know, the decision was already made for me. And so really what I decided was just to cut the nonsense and not pretend that that didn't exist, because I knew the second they announced that I would be the restaurant critic, people, especially restaurant people, you know, maitre d's and managers would be Googling my name and printing out all the pictures, because that's just what people do. I've done this. I've been on the other side. And, you know, it's extremely easy when the person who is the incoming critic is a millennial who's had a media project on the internet. It's just, yeah. So really, my decision was just to accept the truth of what it meant to be me.
I love that. Let's talk about some reviews. Your most recent review is of Nyambai, a James Beard semifinalist for Best New Restaurant. What is your take on the Oakland-based establishment that serves Cambodian fare with a nod to Khmer culture?
I think that the concept is really solid, and there's so much thought put into every inch of that restaurant. You know, because Knight Yun, the owner and chef, has made Khmer rock and roll like the sub-theme of the restaurant, right? And so many things about it exist in service to that. And so it is like a very comprehensive argument in a restaurant. I think those are the concepts that I really like, where everything is thoughtful and there is a through line that makes sense here.
The title speaks volumes, the title of the review. It's Nyambai Resurrects the Dead.
Yeah, thank you. I feel like headlines are my weakest link here as far as my writing ability, so I appreciate that.
But talk about that a little for people who may not know the history of the music kind of getting wiped out or shunted to the side, and also the food.
Right. For those listeners who don't know, the majority of Cambodians in the diaspora left the country because of the Khmer Rouge, right? The Khmer Rouge was this very oppressive regime, a military regime that executed intellectuals and musicians, artists, people who were politically not correct to them. And that included all of the musicians, essentially, who made up this very vibrant, like surf rock inflected scene back in the day in the 60s. And that includes a lot of the artists that are on the playlist at Nyambai. And so to theme a restaurant after that is really interesting. It's really significant for someone like Knight Yun, who is a refugee, was born from refugees, and spent her life kind of putting together the pieces of her family's culture, which had almost been completely erased. The recipes, for instance, you know, a lot of the people who cooked those recipes died. They were killed. A lot of the people who made that music, the majority of them were also murdered. And so to put all of that together into one project is a political act, and it is an act of reclamation. I think that story is so fascinating.
So I have to ask you about one decision, and I don't know if it's a blanket decision you've made or if you made the decision just for this particular review, and that is your decision not to translate the names of dishes that aren't in English.
Yeah. So I have been thinking about that a lot. And there are some cases in that review, I have to say, where I do contextualize what it is. I talk about how the Khoi Tiev is a lot like Hu Tiu, like the Vietnamese, you know, noodle dish. I talk about how this one glass noodle dish is, you know, a tangle. I try to use some descriptors so that people understand what I'm talking about. But essentially, that is what is said on the menu, right? They don't provide like a name that is equivalent like the Cambodian omelet or, you know, something like that. And I think that in itself is an interesting political decision. Again, like everything we do, right, is inflected with either like a resistance to the politics or an allowance for it. And so not translating those names for me just felt like honoring like, okay, this is what the menu actually says. So I should, you know, at least on a practical level, people should be able to see that's what I ordered and that's what I should order, right? I don't know, for a writer like me, right, who has had to translate my experience when writing about my family's food, I thought that not doing so would be, I don't know, an act of rebellion.
Perfect. Thank you so much. What a pleasure to meet you. Hopefully we'll be able to eat together someday soon.
Let me know if you're ever up here.
I will for sure. That's Soleil Ho, the new restaurant critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. We look forward to reading and hearing more from her here on Good Food. Now for another new face. Last year, the New York Times named Tejal Rao as its first California food critic. It was yet another sign of our state's recognition as a dining powerhouse.
I've only been here about 4 or 5 months, and it feels like home already.
I'm catching up with Tejal now to hear about her experience of California so far. including her recent tour of LA's classic restaurants. First of all, welcome.
Thank you.
Tejal, do me a favor, just so that people know who you are. You have this remit from the New York Times to cover California, which seems like an unbelievable job. Was this something that you were pushing for a long time, or was it sprung on you?
A little bit of both. I was secretly hoping to be posted out here for a long time. My family is out here. I visit a couple of times a year, and I'd sort of behind the scenes fallen in love with Los Angeles a little bit, but I didn't think that there was an opportunity until I got a call from my boss, actually the day before I was flying out to visit my brother in LA. And he said, just think about it. And I tried to play it cool, but I was just so thrilled.
And before the move, what was your beat?
I didn't have much of a beat. I covered restaurants. I did stories about dogs who were being trained to sniff beehives in Maryland. I wrote about food trucks and wrote profiles of cooks, wrote about home cooking culture as well. I mean, a very, very general food beat.
Which is just the best.
Yeah, exactly.
And so to now have it focused more on restaurant reviewing, is that something that you find challenging? Have you done it before?
I have done restaurant reviewing before for about a year at the Village Voice in New York and then for a couple of years at Bloomberg News. It feels very different here, though, because it's not a weekly city beat. So I have not figured out how it's going to work. But I'm hoping that the other things I'm curious about can find their way into the restaurant criticism. Like I can write about non-restaurant-y things as well, because I think that broader view is really important everywhere, but in California especially.
And it's not a city beat. It's the entire state.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're going to have to figure out if San Franciscans are going to go, hey, she forgot about us, which would be a first, she says bitterly. You had this extraordinary childhood in terms of the number of places you lived and the amount that your family moved. So did this also extend to your palate as a child?
It did. I mean, I was a very picky eater as a child. My family thinks it's hilarious that I write about food now because they remember me as the kid who would only eat, you know, white foods or nothing spicy. Or that was a long time ago. We moved from London to rural France when I was about 9 years old. After that move, I was no longer disgusted by textures, or something shifted, and I became a more curious and excited eater and wanted to eat everything.
And what about at home? Did either of your parents cook?
Yeah, both of my parents, they both still cook. My mother would cook throughout the week, and then my father would cook on the weekends. And we would go out to restaurants just a few times a year for really, really special occasions. So my mother is East African Asian. She's born in Uganda and raised in Kenya, but of Indian origin. And my father is from India, and they met in high school in Kenya. They come from very different Indian regions and represent different regional cuisines. But we ate probably Indian vegetarian food once a week, and then they would cook all kinds of other stuff throughout the week. And as a treat, we would get chicken Kiev from Marks and Spencer's, the frozen kind, where you cut into it and the butter seeps out.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about this experience that you had, which I think is so smart, of coming to a new city, a city that has a lot to absorb, a lot to taste, and to start first with the old stalwarts. You started your exploration close to your new home. So let's talk about King Taco. What should we know about it?
I don't know if I have anything to teach LA about King Taco, a city that is very familiar already with King Taco, but the tacos are delicious at King Taco. It's good fast food. For fast food tacos, I think that they're great. And to try and understand my neighborhood, I was just going to local places. The King Taco is really bustling on a Friday and Saturday night. It's people from different generations. It's locals. It's the lengua tacos seem to be really big, but the al pastor are the tacos with history. because the founder of King Taco was, I believe, one of the first people to sell those pork tacos in the city, originally at a truck and then later at this location of King Taco in Cypress Park.
Yeah, Raul Martinez mm-hmm. is the guy who popularized them, mm-hmm. one could say. So where else did you visit?
I went to Philippe's, which I absolutely loved. You know, sitting in Philippe's, smearing a little bit too much of the hot mustard on...
Everybody does on the that.
Yeah, it's a very hard balance to find. I was continuously making myself weep, but enjoying it. It's a really diverse dining room. It was such a pleasure to sit in there and be a part of it.
Yeah, they get a lot of workers
yeah.
who work in downtown L.A. I understand you also went to Cielito Lindo.
Mm-hmm. I actually went back there a few times, even though this wasn't the kind of review that necessitated repeat visits. I kept going back there because I thought that the taquitos were so delicious and it was such a fun place to people watch as well. And watching the cooks in the groove of frying and then dousing them in the sauce. They really had a beautiful rhythm, and it was really fun to watch.
And then you ended up at Tam O'Shanter,
yes.
which I think is a place that everybody in the neighborhood there in Atwater
mm-hmm.
knows it. And a lot of people forget about it, people who don't live close.
Before I went, I had imagined it to be a kind of tourist attraction. And I think writing this story just undid a lot of the things I thought were true. It appears that way, and everyone's in the tartan outfits and the hats, and there's the old Walt Disney drawings are all over the walls. It feels a bit fusty, but at lunchtime, it was really all regulars reading their newspaper, eating their prime rib, creamed spinach, mashed potatoes, just really perfect. Yeah, really.
Perfect. This sort of realization that you had about who populated these dining rooms mm-hmm. seems to be a big takeaway for you. Could you talk about that in light of New York?
Yes. The reason I wanted to do this story, I don't want to pretend I have an expertise of Los Angeles yet. I'm a newcomer, and I thought it was really important to start with these places and kind of learn something from them or pick up all these fragments and try to put together some kind of lesson for myself. But one of the things I'm trying to do is not use New York as a reference point as much as possible. Los Angeles is shaped by different patterns of immigration. It's shaped by different politics. And as much as possible, I want to not compare it to New York.
But you do say that what surprised you was the diversity of the dining rooms, not
yeah.
just racially, but age-wise.
Yeah, yeah, in every possible way. That feels very different from New York City. It also feels very normal. It feels as it should.
How nice to know that we're normal.
Yeah.
We're normal in some way.
Yeah, dining rooms that are full of wealthy white people do not feel normal.
Well, it's a pleasure to bring you into our culture. We relish having you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Tejal Rao, the California restaurant critic for the New York Times. Find a link to her article on old school Los Angeles restaurants on our website. Visit kcrw.com/goodfood. After the break, I'm talking to one of our resident food critics, Bill Addison. He recently went looking for legit Lebanese food in LA. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Now we're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Now we turn to Bill Addison, restaurant critic for the LA Times. He's here to tell us about a new restaurant.
Good morning, Evan.
Where are we going?
We are going, you know, restaurant critics are supposed to love everything, and I really do, but I also love some cuisines more than others. And so we're going to Lebanon.
You love Lebanese food.
I love the contrasts of it. I love the freshness of it. I love how the meats like are meaty and the vegetables are like pristine and the richness of the olive oil. And yeah, just makes me happy.
So who is the representation? Who is representing Lebanese food?
So we're talking about Hyatt's Kitchen in Hollywood Hills. It is the new second location of a decade-old North Hollywood institution. The chef there has been in the restaurant industry for a long time, had several restaurants, Hassan Shatila. It's interesting. I was sort of alerted to, like, my ears perked up at his last name, Shatila, because that is the name of a very famous bakery in Dearborn, Michigan, which is really the country's, America's center for great Lebanese dining. And so I saw his name and I was like, and sure enough, that's his brother.
Wow.
Yeah, and so he has all the recipes for these amazing variations on baklava, not just the one that you know, like filled with ground walnuts, but variations with cashew and pistachio and an incredibly good mamoul, which is really like light, cakey cookie filled with date paste. So to kind of jump to the finale, the sweets are really good at Hyatt's Kitchen, and they have them on display in a front counter. You could even just stop by and take them home to enjoy them.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you about my favorite things from that part of the world.
Please.
So what about the mujadra?
The mujadra is really solid there. That is a mix of rice and lentils, and the really crucial ingredient with mujadra is very deeply caramelized onions.
In copious quantities.
In copious quantities. So it's really solid here. I would say the thing that's best about Hyatt's Kitchen are their meats.
So are we talking about kibbeh and kibinaya?
Kibinaya, that's one of my favorite things to eat. So that is basically the Lebanese version of steak tartare, to make it as accessible as possible. It is crucial that the meat just be impeccably fresh. I think you'd really dig this version, Evan. It's raw beef here. Often it's raw lamb, more traditionally lamb, but beef is a fine substitute, and that's what they have here, that has been kneaded with bulgur wheat. And so it just has a little bit of texture to it and just some really subtle spicing. The key thing is to really douse kibinaya with olive oil, and they have cruets on the table. When I went, the service was a little green and acclimating, so they didn't tell you to do that. But we started to eating it, and I was like, why doesn't this taste right? And then I was like, we're missing the olive oil. And my friends were like, oh, yeah, I get it. Like, it's sort of almost like it punctuates the textures in a really interesting way.
And what about the fried kibbeh?
So that's a variation, basically the same thing, the ground meat plus bulgur that's turned into an outer casing, essentially, with a filling of more ground meat and pine nuts. Really lovely. And it is a superb version there.
I'm very hungry right now.
Let's go right now. It's a little bit of a trek, but we can do it. The vegetable dishes are probably the weak link. If you're a vegetarian, which is Lebanese cuisine is often a great choice for a meat-free meal, and it's fine here. It's not going to blow you away. What really blew me away at Hyatt's Kitchen were the meats and the sweets.
There you go. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thank you, Evan.
That was LA Times restaurant critic Bill Addison on Hyatt's Kitchen in Hollywood Hills. Find a link to his LA Times review on the Good Food website. Lebanon belongs to the historic Levant, a fertile region just east of the Mediterranean with a growing climate like Southern California's. Since next month's pie contest will feature Levantine cuisine as a special category, I'm turning to another food tradition from this part of the world.
They call that area the Fertile Crescent, and it's called that for a reason. You know, a tomato would be so fragrant and juicy and aromatic, you could just eat it like an apple. I had this real mix of seeing a really challenging political situation and then finding a lot of joy and beauty.
That's food writer Yasmin Khan. Her research trips to modern Palestine have produced a book full of personal stories and recipes that will remind you of California's bounty, from colorful meze to fresh seafood. Hi.
Hi, it's so nice to be here.
It's wonderful to have you here in person. Your first visit to Israel and the West Bank was about a decade ago, and you were working for a British human rights charity. What were your first impressions?
Oh, I think I found it quite shocking, just on a very human level. I mean, coming from London to kind of be immersed in this place where there are soldiers and there are checkpoints and there are walls was very striking. So I think that was a huge part of it. And then at the same time, I also fell in love with the region a little bit amidst the challenges that I saw. It's an incredibly warm part of the world, both emotionally as well as the weather. And from a culinary point of view, I was blown away by what I ate.
How does the occupation affect how people are able to cook and put food on the table every day?
Oh, it just affects it in every single way. Like, your ability as a Palestinian to move is so restricted. There are checkpoints set up throughout the West Bank. You need permits to travel into Israel. In places like the Gaza Strip, which for the last 11 years has been blockaded by the Israeli army with no movement and all goods kind of monitored. In the last 11 years, some of the items that have been prescribed against that you haven't been able to get into Gaza have included things like chocolate, lentils, and pasta. And now, 80% of people in Gaza, according to the United Nations, are dependent on food aid. So you can't really get away from it. And what I wanted to do with my book is, this is a bit of the world that we all hear about in the news so much. And I wanted to just kind of get beyond some of those headlines and share intimate tales of how Palestinians within this context are living their lives. And the resilience that I saw was just so inspiring.
So let's talk about some of the places you visited and what foods ground them, root them. Let's talk about Nablus.
So Nablus was a fascinating place to visit. It really felt like a very vibrant Palestinian city. And it's in the middle of the West Bank. And it is perhaps most famous for kanafi, which is this incredible dessert. I kind of describe it as like the love child between baklava and cheesecake. So it's kind of warm akawi cheese, which kind of has the texture of mozzarella, but, not salted. And it's layered with this crunchy phyllo or semolina crust, and then doused in orange blossom and cardamom-scented syrup. So it's like gooey, crunchy. Oh, it's so Moorish. And it's famous from originating in Nablus. And that was one of the biggest delights that I had when I ate there.
Yum. And talk about the link between Gaza and dill.
This was a really interesting discovery for me. So, Persian food uses a lot of dill and a lot of herbs, and I'm a big fan. I think dill's one of those herbs that can divide people, but, I embrace it. But in Gazan cuisine, dill forms one of what I describe as the holy trinity of Gazan flavors. It sits alongside chilies and garlic to form the bedrock of Gazan cuisine. Dill, the fronds, smashed and cut up and used in salads or used to stuff fish. But the seeds are also used, dill seeds, which I'd never used before, ground down again and added to soups or stews. It's kind of slightly sweet anise flavor that comes through, not very intense, but just very subtle.
You talk about the three different profiles of Palestinian flavors.
Yes. Palestinian cookery can be divided into three main types. You've got the food from the Galilee, which is perhaps what we associate more with, Levantine cuisines, those bright, fresh salads like fattoush or herb-flecked tabbouleh, lovely stuffed eggplants and peppers, maybe braised okra. It's very vegetable-focused, very seasonal, local, plant-based. And then you have the food from the West Bank, which is more influenced by Bedouin culture. It's the desert. It's a lot drier. Food there tends to be a bit more meat-focused, lots more bread. One of my favorite dishes from that region is this beautiful dish called moussakan, which are kind of roast pieces of chicken that are marinated in loads of sumac and allspice and then roasted and layered over flatbreads with red onions with the roasting juices poured over. So it just soaks into the bread and you tear it apart. And then there's the food from Gaza, which again, is very different, a lot punchier, a lot more spice, a lot more sour, tastes with the use of pomegranate molasses in stews. I guess iconically, Gazan cuisine traditionally had such an emphasis on seafood. Things like kibbeh, these little kind of pounded meatballs that we know commonly made with lamb, you know, in Gaza would be made with fish. And you might have, you know, again, shrimp stews or stuffed squid, you know, really, really vibrant seafood and fish-based.
One of my really favorite parts of the book is the vegetable chapter. So I have to ask you first, the quick pickled avocados, describe them and tell me where you discovered them.
This was just in a kitchen in Ramallah visiting some friends. And, you know, we've all had that situation where you've got an avocado that's a bit firm, but you're like, it's okay, I'm going to crack into it. It's going to be all right. Then you cut it open and it's too firm and you're like, oh, why didn't I wait? And then what do you do with it? You know, well, here is a recipe. You can make a very quick pickle just using some apple cider vinegar, some aromatic herbs. I like to use, I think, cilantro seeds, some garlic, again, maybe some dill. You just place all of that in with the avocados, pop them in the fridge for a couple of hours, and they soften. And it's just a wonderful way to just use up hard avocados. I really recommend it.
I see a whole different version of avocado toast popping. So you were talking about kefteh, and so much of the food is formed into little balls, which I love. But you have an eggplant and feta one that just looks gorgeous.
Yeah, it's very tactile, actually, now that we think about it in that way. So much of Palestinian cookery, you know, whether it's kneading dough or stuffing squash, or, you know, hand-rolling maftoul, which is this type of kind of giant couscous. It's always described that way, but I always think of it more as a pasta because it doesn't lose its shape. That element of cooking and creating dishes with your hands is definitely there. And, you know, the recipes in this book, you know, there are some traditional Palestinian ones, but things like that eggplant and feta kefta, really kind of my interpretations of ingredients that I was inspired by. You know, I like cooking with vegetables. I like creating kind of vegetarian versions of Middle Eastern classics. And these are just made with lovely ground bulgur wheat. Again, lots of fresh herbs, some pine nuts, some lemon zest. It's really great picnic food, or, you know, if you're kind of got people coming around and want little starters.
So let's talk about a couple of the Gazan dishes. Gazan lentils. Oh, that looks so delicious. Describe that.
Yeah, so they are just, you know, your everyday kind of brown or green lentil that you cook with chard and loads of garlic, and then you season it with garlic and green chili, and then, crucially, some tahini. Now, in Gaza, again, this is something new to me, they have this special type of tahini called red tahini, which is toasted, you know, so it has that affinity that we kind of associate with Far Eastern cuisines. So it adds this kind of slight smokiness, nutty flavor, and with the lemon and the garlic and the chili, it's a really kind of earthy meal. I love it.
And then you have a soup that's almost a soup version of that, where it's a sour lemon soup with a, you call it a cilantro walnut smash.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the reasons I probably fell in love with Palestinian food is because of those affinities that it has with Persian food. And of course, you know, if you're making a Persian dish, you're going to just put as many herbs in there as you can. So that soup is the same. Again, I love recipes that are the kind of stuff that you might have in the store cupboard, but then you just zhuzh them up, as I say, with a bit of freshness at the end. The herb and walnut smash, which is like cilantro leaves, some walnuts, some garlic, is a really good way of enlivening a simple lentil soup.
So beautiful and delicious. Let's talk about okra, which I love. When I encounter a really great okra dish from this part of the world, I'm so happy and I just sort of want to just gorge on it. You give a tip that I've never heard anybody give before, which is not to trim the stems down too much.
That's right. I also love okra. I think it's just got a bad rep.
Totally.
You know, I mean, anything, if you don't cook it properly, won't taste nice. But at the same time, if you cook things properly, they taste good. And with okra, it's about not overcooking it and to stop it getting that gloopy texture, which I think is the thing that people who don't like it have issue with. What I recommend is, say if you've got the stem of the fruit, and it is a fruit, not a vegetable, you don't kind of cut it all off. You try and leave some of it intact, and that keeps the liquid inside of it intact when it's cooking. And so it doesn't collapse on itself. In my braised okra recipe, I actually also recommend roasting it first. So again, you're not adding more liquid to something which could potentially make it go too soft.
Yeah. Oh, it looks so beautiful. So you met the founder of the Palestinian Seed Library.
Mm.
So this is such an interesting project to me because it speaks to a lot of the challenges that are going on there and to a sense of rootedness. Can you talk about her and what they're trying to do?
Yeah, so this is an incredible botanist called Vivian Sansour, and this is just outside of Bethlehem. And I think one of the reasons why that story of a seed library that's trying to collect heirloom varieties of different Palestinian vegetables and fruits, the reason why I thought it was so important is because actually this is a very similar issue that we see resonate in farming communities all over the world. You know, we have got into the situation over the last 50 years of the types of seeds we are using dramatically reducing. And of course, the impact that has on the soil, but also just actually for us and our tastes, you know. So she's doing this incredible work collecting, keeping a library of seeds, and then encouraging local farmers to use different seeds instead of just being reliant on the big, cheap one that they can get from a multinational corporation.
Yeah, she said, I think in your book, you talk about how she said that she returned and realized that because of the constraints on food moving in and out, that there had become more and more reliance on more industrialized food products, which sounds so familiar. But then for her, like, her touch point was a purple carrot. And I thought to myself, we have purple carrots here.
Yeah.
How interesting to know that the purple carrot that we can buy at the Santa Monica Farmers Market has this link to memory for a woman in Palestine. Absolutely beautiful. And a delight to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Yasmin Khan, award-winning author of The Saffron Tales, Recipes from the Persian Kitchen. We've been discussing her latest cookbook, Zaytoun. Coming up, we're looking at the world's biggest tomato seedling sale. It's called Tomato Mania. Stick around. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. As we ramp up to tomato season, we look to the expert, Scott Daig.
It's like a company's annual meeting, and everybody comes in and reports on what they did last year and what worked and what did not. And it's just friendly and wonderful, and we really, really love it. It's the best thing about the event.
Scott's the force behind Tomato Mania, the largest tomato seedling sale in the world. It's right here in Southern California. Each spring, Scott takes his latest collection on the road, doling out advice to newbie gardeners and green thumbs alike. How are you doing?
Oh my gosh, I'm great. It's my season.
Yeah.
I have to be good, right?
Right.
I mean, gosh, it's a lot to do and, you know, but it's all around tomatoes. So it's fun and it keeps me going and it kind of, it makes me smile.
So let's talk about tomato cultivation first and then we'll get into the event. What do you suggest? Okay, we're going to dig that hole and then if we're going in directly into the ground, or even if we're in boxes.
Boxes or containers or raised beds, which everybody's doing.
What do we put in the hole before we put the plant in?
Every rich thing you can think of. Every amend. I mean, that's what it's all about the soil. If they don't have a home, a medium that provides for them and nurtures them, and we know this, it's not going to work. So what do you put in? Compost. More compost. A good planting mix. I love working with hays and greens and you know, getting some of these masses to decompose for me. But look, you can buy great bagged product today that has all sorts of stuff in it. Mix it up. Provide a lot of stuff in when you're doing that. Amend the whole garden, amend the whole where you're planting. Never stop.
So when you say never stop, once we get the plants in and we gently water them and they settle, after that first flush of amendments that we put in, how often should we be top dressing?
Never stop. Top dressing, you know, the whole thing about, we don't have to dig it all into 6 feet, right? We just have to top dress. We have to do what forests do. We have to layer on top. We have to allow and encourage decomp. And then the microorganisms do the rest. I think, look, it's not going to hurt you to put a little soil or whatever it is around the base of your plant. It'll root into that. So tomatoes, that is. And so we can, and I encourage you to, heck, every 2 weeks, put something on top of that garden. It's not only going to insulate from wind and sun, as a mulch should, so it performs as a mulch, but it encourages breakdown. As you water, it feeds. All those nutrients are just filtered over the roots. And because our soils in California are just not really high on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, mine might be a 3, doing, you know, I tell people, hey, every time you're at the nursery where you can get a good quality product, buy a great compost, buy something and just layer it out there in the tomato garden.
Okay, so let's talk the event this year. How many varieties?
Well, we have what I do as Tomato Mania is I go outside the norm. I custom grow varieties and beautiful things that aren't currently being offered by commercial growers in the area, whom we love and whom support us, you know, dearly. So how many do I grow? I guess through the season, I will grow just over 200 varieties that are, again, on the fringes. And then the great news is that this event has encouraged, Tomato Mania encourages growers and commercial growers to have a bigger list, frankly, because people want more now. And so I can glean from that list as well. So we put those two together, and my biggest sales will have close to 300 varieties.
It's just the most unbelievable thing to just walk down the aisles and try really hard to not overbuy, because then you'll end up with poor plants that, you know, are never going to go in the ground.
Most of us are not successful in that. You should see my truck.
So when Tomato Mania first started, and for many, many years, the buzzword was heirlooms.
Right.
Let's go back to seeds that have been passed on from generation to generation to generation. There have always been some that are remarkably successful and some that are tough.
Yes.
What is the buzzword this year?
Well, I don't know if there's one. A lot of what we're still hearing, and I don't remember the last time we talked, so I don't know if we talked about this, is blue. You know, there's blue phase in tomatoes that makes it beautiful and healthy and all of that. And you're correct. You know, Tomato Mania started because of heirlooms. Nobody grew that, or nobody was able to purchase an heirloom plant of that variety ever. And so that's how it began. These days, you know, if there's a buzzword, you know what it might be? Marriage. In other words, taking an heirloom variety and crossing it with a modern variety. Kind of sort of like the English roses. Everybody, any gardeners out there will know that, where you get the shapes, the intense flavors, all of that of an heirloom, but you get the disease resistance and you get the productivity of a hybrid. So, for instance, last year we had our tomato of the year last year was one called Madame Marmande, a beautiful red, slightly ribbed, glorious hybrid tomato. And hybrid's no longer a dirty word. We are finding so many hybrids that are in the, you know, the fifth page of the catalog, right? That nobody pays attention to. We've tested them. We love them. And for all intents and purposes, they are as rare or as unusual as any heirloom. So I think the blending is maybe what's happening in most of the tomato world and what we're most excited about.
One highlight of this year's Tomato Mania will be that you have added many, many more varieties of peppers to your lineup.
We have. It's a big deal for us. We've always had peppers, but this year and really over the last two or three, my team has been terrific in saying, hey, let's expand a little bit and let's offer, because people are asking. And, you know, with nurseries going away, like we've all watched in the last 10, 15 years, we can be another outlet. And as per our Tomato Mania culture, we'll grow 30 to 50 varieties outside the norm that nobody currently carries.
Well, thank you so much.
Always good to see you. Thanks for having us.
I've been talking to Scott Daig about Tomato Mania, the largest tomato seedling sale in the world. Today and tomorrow, they'll be at the Tapia Brothers Farm Stand in Encino, selling more than 300 varieties of tomato seedlings. They'll be around from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on both days. Visit tomatomania.com to learn more. After the break, we're going out with the market report. Stay with us. Welcome back to KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. We close out our show at the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Here is beloved Laura Avery.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm excited today to be talking to a newly arrived chef here in Los Angeles and, of course, a wonderful welcome new customer at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market. Danielle Sobel is executive chef at a just-opened restaurant in West Hollywood called Pacifique. And Danielle, you are fresh from New York City. You specialize in Japanese cuisine, and you are just having too much fun at your new restaurant, exploring dishes, applying your craft, and now discovering the Santa Monica Farmers Market. So can you tell us a little bit about your technique and what you're shopping for today?
My background has always been izakaya cuisine specifically, which is kind of food based to drink with. There's different variations of it. I typically delve into more high-end izakayas, which have sashimi, a lot of grilled dishes, but very simple approach to food, trying to find the best ingredients possible and doing as little as you can to them. And very excited to be exploring California. I think the first thing I did was buy a car and then make my way to the Santa Monica market. I don't know which was more exciting, the car or the market. I've never experienced anything like this in New York. I mean, the Union Square market is lovely, but I swear my pupils dilated when I saw all the produce here. It was just, it was moving.
And so what are you shopping for today here at the market?
Today I'm shopping for my shrimp cloud dish that's served with salt shore mussels in a broth made with dashi, Meyer lemon juice, and nira, which is what I bought today, which is a garlic chive. Mm-hmm. And I decorate it with a little bit of rampini flowers, which I also bought here.
Oh, and they are brilliant yellow. And rampini's kind of a mustardy.
Yes.
Right, flavor? And then so the nira is something people may just walk right by because it's a chive. So yeah. What's so special about a nira?
Well, they're a little bit larger than chives, and they have a lot of flavor, but it's more subtle and deep. Where when I try, and my approach to food is trying to use subtle, deeper versions of things that might come off as a bit harsh on the palate, like instead of using straight salt or soy sauce, I try and find other ways around that. So to me, nira is like the perfect balance of garlicky, allium vibe, mm-hmm. just a little more subtle and you feel it. It's like getting a hug when you're drinking the broth.
That sounds delightful and delicious.
And it gives such a vibrant green color.
Mm-hmm. How do you layer this entire dish together?
Well, I start with a shrimp cloud that I make with grinding shrimp and cod paste. And I emulsify that together by grating mountain yam, and then it's just briefly steamed. Then the dish will get mussels that are cooked with dashi, shallots, and Meyer lemon juice. And then as it's going on the plate, I remove the mussels and I season the rest of that broth with a lot of nira juice. And it's topped with blanched rapini and rapini flowers and some toast. Mm-hmm. The toast is not just for pescatarians. Unfortunately, I can do another option, but it does have chicken schmaltz on it.
Oh, my goodness. So that is a beautifully, beautifully layered. Now, is that a traditional, the cuisine that you're talking about? Are you just taking this cuisine and just running wild with it?
I'm running a little bit wild. It's kind of like my personality. I have to just keep doing exciting things or I do get bored. But mm-hmm. the shrimp cake is originally called ebi shinjo, and this is my version of it. Mm-hmm. And that's traditional Japanese dish that's usually steamed and served in a thickened dashi broth mm-hmm. that's thickened with potato starch and usually served with mitsuba on top. Mm-hmm. I kind of steered in this direction when I saw nira and these beautiful flowers my first day at the farmer's market.
All right, well, this just sounds like it's amazingly complex, simple, and so inspired at the same time. So
thank you so much. You're making me blush.
Aw. That was Danielle Sobel. She is executive chef at Pacifique, brand new restaurant just opened up at La Cienega near Melrose, and a very inspired, very multi-layered Japanese-flavored cuisine. Talking now with Kevin Yasutomi, who is the farmer who grows the nira that Danielle was just talking about. And nira is garlic chive?
Yeah, garlic chives.
So it looks just like a chive. And how do you grow it?
This is grow on ground, let it grow, and that's basically it.
Okay. And then when you harvest it, are you just pulling it out? Does it have roots? Do you pull it out by the roots? Do you just cut it off?
We cut it off.
Cut it off. Then does it grow back again? Yeah. Oh, over and over and over again?
Yeah, just give a nice little, you know, nice little haircut here and there you go.
Oh, okay. And they get to be about a foot tall. That's the ideal length for your customers?
No, we just cut it that way. No, we don't even bother. We just look at it. Okay, does that look good? Yeah, we'll cut it.
Oh, okay. Is it popular? Because I think a lot of people might walk by and not even know the difference between a garlic chive and an onion chive. Do people ask for it specifically?
Some people do, yeah.
Yeah, those who know.
Those who know or who've used it, mostly people from, like, any part of Asia, basically. Like, oh, hey, I've seen it. Try that. Can I have some of that?
I know that garlic has kind of a triangular-shaped stem, and then onions are more round. Is this got the same thing with more of a triangular-shaped stem to it?
Well, the easiest way to tell from the onion is actually because, like, it's flat. Onions are a little more circular, if you notice it, because, like,
they're tubes,
yeah.
Oh, and the garlic chive is flat.
Yes.
So are you going to have these garlic chive, this nira, are you going to have it all year round?
We sometimes do, yeah.
Okay, and you'll be able to tell people when they walk up, you'll be able to point it out to them or let them know?
Yeah, because unless you're, like, not really paying attention, it's pretty obvious.
Okay, once you know it's got a flat leaf and not a round leaf, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Just, okay, like, that's, just look at it, there you go. Yeah.
Step one, flat leaf.
Yes. Step one, flat leaf. Step two, does it smell like garlic?
Okay, step three, does it taste like garlic?
Exactly, there
All
you
right.
go.
So the three-step verification process, we can be sure we're getting Nira here at Yasutomi Farm.
Or you just look at it and like, oh, hey, there it is.
All right, Kevin. Well, so nice to know. I had not been aware that there was such a thing as a garlic chive, and so love to beat the market, love to learn, and always learn everything I know from you farmers.
You'd be surprised what you find out here. It's like a lot of the stuff, like most of the people that don't even know it exists.
I know. That's why we have these conversations at the market. So thank you for all the information. I feel much better educated.
I don't know. For me, it's like, because I've been growing up with this stuff where it's like, whatever.
So every time, second nature.
Yeah, it's not just second nature. I'm just like, how do you not know this?
Well, you know, I wasn't raised on a farm, okay?
Not everybody. This is understandable.
Not everybody's so lucky.
I wouldn't say lucky, but it's something. It's something unique. It's weird, but
well,
yeah.
You've practically grown up here at the market, Kevin.
Yeah.
How long have you been coming here?
Let's see, I think I was like, about 4 or 5 when I came here, so maybe about almost a little over 25 years.
About 25 years, yeah. I've watched you. I've watched you grow up. So, and then I learned something new from you today, 25 years later. So there's always hope.
Well, you have to learn something every day.
Otherwise, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so too. All right, Kevin. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate the info.
Yeah, sure. No problem.
That was Kevin Yasutomi, and he has grown up on the farm. He's practically grown up here at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market and schooling us in the difference between the garlic chive and the onion chive. It's always good to learn something new. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Before we go, just a reminder to sign up for the pie contest that's happening on April 28th at UCLA's Royce Quad. It is not too late to enter in our 9 categories. Register and learn more at kcrw.com/pie. That's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or on Stitcher, and as always, leave us a review if you liked what you heard. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Abby Swanson and Kenny Eng. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I will be back next week with more Good Food.